Yesterday, the Iowa Senate passed a bill to decriminalize medical cannabis oil for the treatment of epilepsy. It was a response to pleas of Iowa parents with children stricken by seizures. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll check in with Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell to find out what's been happening in the final days of this session. Also, a security breach discovered this week in ISU's computer system. Dean Borg on last night's GOP U.S. Republican Senate candidate debate. Amy Mayer on the evolution of the local food movement. And Des Moines-based publisher Meredith Corporation ceases the monthly production of Ladies Home Journal. Your Friday News Buzz edition starts right after this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about some of the news of this week that we didn't get to otherwise during our talk shows. Coming up a little bit later in the hour, we'll learn about a security breach discovered this week at Iowa State University's computer system. Dean Borg in the second half of our program on last night's GOP U.S. Republican Senate candidate debate. Amy Mayer on the evolution of the local food movement, which you may have heard she's been reporting on this week. We heard the news yesterday that Des Moines-based publisher Meredith Corporation is ceasing the monthly production of one of its signature magazines, Ladies Home Journal. We'll find out why that decision was made, and we'll hear about a new mental health crisis center to open in Polk County. But first of all, yesterday the Iowa Senate voted 36-12 to pass a bill that would decriminalize medical cannabis oil, this for the treatment of epilepsy, a response to the pleas of Iowa parents with children stricken by seizures. Joining us now for a few minutes to talk about this bill and other goings-on in the final days of the legislature for this session, Joyce Russell, our State House correspondent for Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Now, let's talk about this medical marijuana bill. Earlier in the year, I understand no one thought medical marijuana had a chance, and now it's looking like its limited use, very limited use, might become legal in Iowa. How did this happen?
Well, you know, we reported on a news conference very early in the session, and there were these parents, moms there, who were pushing for this very limited use of medical marijuana for their children who suffered from seizures. And at that time, Senator Joe Bolcom, who is the leading advocate for this, he announced at this news conference this bill is not going to go this year. We just don't have the bipartisan support for it. Well, I was there and I saw these women just go into a flat-out mom rage saying, what do you mean? It's early in the session. What do you mean that this can't be done? And they lobbied hard. And, you know, over the course of the months of the legislature, it just turned people's minds around. And so, you know, it's not a done deal yet. I just noticed that it's scheduled for a committee meeting in the House this afternoon. And the House Speaker promised to give the bill a look. But and I also just walked past one of these mothers, Maria LaFrance and Sally Gare, were the two women who've been so active. And I just walked by her in the lobby, and she was bending a lawmaker's ear. So they're both still working very hard to try to get passage this year.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about what the bill stipulates. Explain that to us. It's only cannabis oil? How is that used, and what component does it have in there that's interesting for epileptic seizures?
Well, it has a certain chemical that it has been effective for treating seizures. The most important thing, though, is what it doesn't have, which is the element of marijuana that helps you get high, the THC element. And the bill says that this can have 3% or less of that element. And one of the moms who's lobbying for this bill said that from what she's learned, that if weed doesn't have 9%, nobody even puts over out any money to get it. So, I mean, should just use that as an example of how you can't get high on this. And so it's a very limited use. And I should say it's also limited only to people suffering from this kind of epilepsy. So other people who have medical issues, pain, chronic pain, and so on, who also believe that they could benefit from the treatment of medical marijuana. They are not covered in this bill. It's a very narrow bill.
Mm-hmm. So what have the opponents, and there are some to this, there's been some heated debate about this, what have been their concerns if you can't get high on this oil? Why are some still opposed to legalizing it for this narrow medical use against seizures?
Well, because I believe some people feel that this is an opening for further decriminalization. And actually, Ben, the way it's worded, it's worded that this is decriminalizing marijuana for these families. They won't be able to buy it here. It's not produced here. They have to travel to another state. But when they come back with it, they cannot be prosecuted or arrested. So it is decriminalizing marijuana. And, you know, and that just makes people nervous because frankly, if this bill becomes law, I'm sure that others who with medical conditions will feel like, okay, we've got an opening and we'll be back. And that's what makes people nervous.
Right, right. It seems like you've got leverage. Well, if you let in to help people with the epileptic seizures, why not other with other chronic conditions?
Right. And I should also say, you know, they'll be traveling to Colorado, or I heard one of the mothers say that they might not even have enough of it in Colorado, or there may be some other obstacles in Colorado and they have to go to the northwestern United States. Mm-hmm. But one of the arguments, the governor's Office of Drug Control Policy, he said he's worried about reciprocity. In other words, if Iowa has this connection with Colorado, they feel also that would open the door to, okay, whatever is legal in Colorado could be legal here. And, marijuana opponents don't want that.
You said this afternoon it could go to a House committee.
It is scheduled for
that.
Mm-hmm.
Any indication of whether Governor Branstad would sign this bill if it made it to his desk?
Well, his remarks also changed over the course of the session. He was giving the standard anti-marijuana comments at the beginning of the session, and his comments have changed. He said in a statement when we reported on this week, his spokesman put out a statement that said the governor sympathizes with these families, and he will, I think, carefully review any bill that reaches his desk, but of course it has to get through the House first.
Okay, we'll keep our eye on that, Joyce, and perhaps hear some more of your reporting on that with developments this afternoon at the State House. Let's talk about Greyhound racing. We've been reporting on that at Iowa Public Radio. We've been providing information. The future of Greyhound racing, the subject of debate late in the session. Where is that at now?
Well, there's a bill that's making its way through the legislature that is the result of, I should say, years of discussions between the casinos and the Greyhound breeders. And they have finally come up with what they call a soft landing for the Greyhound breeders. The casinos want to get rid of the Greyhound racing. It is a drain on their profits. Interest in it, once they put slot machines at the racetracks, the popularity of the racing started going down. And this is really, it's true all over the country. Greyhound race tracks are closing down all over the country. But the casinos are making a very strong effort to communicate that the kind of soft landing that they're making for the Greyhound breeders is, they call it unprecedented. Every place else, the tracks are just shutting down and the breeders are going out of business. But the casinos have put up $36 million for a fund to help the breeders who want to get out of the business get out, and then another $36 million for the breeders who want to stay in the business and they want to try to make it on their own with a freestanding independent track in Dubuque.
Mm-hmm. And also some part of the bill addressing the Greyhound dogs who would no longer be needed, right?
Right. That's part of that $36 million fund to help the breeders who want to get out of the business. There will be money there are currently, as I learned yesterday, only three adoption agencies. Now, there are these adoption agencies for what they call no-kill adoption. They have to promise the dogs will be adopted and not, offered for research or the other things that can happen. And so now there's actually going to be money for those. The Racing and Gaming Commission will distribute that money to anyone who wants to get in the business of Greyhound adopting. And you know, there's a lot of – we learned this week that there are currently 3,000 greyhounds in the state, several hundred breeders, and many of those are in a situation where they're in training now, or even mother dogs about to have babies. I mean, you know, so this is the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And what the greyhound folks say is that the breeding has already been cut way back in anticipation of this happening.
Mm-hmm. So at the end of this session, the question we always seem to end up at this time of the year, the adjournment, is it clear when that will happen? I heard as soon as this weekend, possibly.
No, when I get back to the Capitol, I hope they've been saying afternoon they'll have a better idea. It doesn't look like they're going to. But the idea was, well, the reason they're in session today, Friday, when they're usually not in Friday, is because Thursday night, it looked like it was conceivable that they could come back on Friday and then stay on Saturday and finish it up. It looks less hopeful that that's going to happen. And so they'll be back next week is my prediction.
Okay, Joyce Russell, we'll let you get back to the State House, the scramble there to get bills drafted and amended. And we'll hear about it from Iowa Public Radio's correspondent. Joyce Russell, nice to talk with you again. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Des Moines area soon will have another option for people going through mental health crises. A public center for short-term treatment is scheduled to open in July. The center will be run by the Ierley Ball Mental Health Agency. Joining us now, Cynthia Steidel-Bishop, Chief Operating Officer for Ierley Ball Community Mental Health Services. Hi, Cynthia.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So, Cynthia, why does Polk County need this sort of mental health crisis center?
Well, a lot of times when people are in crisis, they will go to the emergency room, and then they'll get an assessment, and then they're sent back home. And because what a hospital does is when someone is suicidal, then they go to the emergency room. But a lot of times people have a crisis, but they just need somebody to talk to. So that's what the 23-hour crisis center will do is we'll have mental health professionals, we'll have registered nurses that will be available 24 hours a day, and people can then go to the crisis center to get an assessment. They will be observed for as long as they need to be, and then up to 23 hours, and then they will get a referral for services.
So this is kind of like a quick clinic. If we were talking about a physical ailment, non-mental health issue, we have these quick clinics, and this is sort of that vein?
You know, it kind of is. It kind of is. It helps people who need an immediate intervention. It's kind of like an urgent care clinic, like you were just referring to. So it's when people have some depression, but they're not suicidal, but they need someone to talk to immediately. Or if they're having anxiety, they can come down to the crisis center. And then we'll also have a med provider there 2 hours a day. So they can come down, they can get an assessment, then they can actually have the opportunity to meet with a med provider that day, which is unheard of because it's so hard to get into med providers immediately. So we're going to have that option available. And then we're going to have nurses and people. If people have some physical problems, they'll be able to be assessed for that as well. There's nothing like that in Des Moines. We have a mobile crisis response team that can go out and see people in their homes, but they're dispatched through the police, and it's a very short term. We're there just for a few mm-hmm. hours. We do an assessment, and then we get them hooked up with services, but this is a little bit longer term. Where they can be observed on a longer-term basis and then get a really solid assessment and referral.
You know, mental health issues, one of the chief challenges over the years is to overcome the taboo that is connected with seeking out mental health services. Is that part of the plan with this type of service as well, to make it sort of a walk-in, an easier access area so that people can feel like they can come there?
Absolutely. It's a very safe place. It will be a really safe place for people to go where they can just walk in and they don't have to. There's not going to be a lot of, you know, hoops they have to jump through in order to get services. And the other thing is a lot of times people don't really know where to go when they have a need. They might call for services. It might be a while before they can get in for services. And it might take a while for them to actually pick up the phone to go somewhere, whereas this, they can just walk in the door and they can get services by a mental health licensed professional or a registered nurse immediately.
Do you expect that Ierley Ball will have some sort of ripple effect on other institutions that deal with those suffering from mental health problems, say emergency rooms or jails in the area?
I have no doubt. This is scheduled to open in July, but I have no doubt that it's going to cut down on the number of emergency room visits because, again, people really don't know where to go when they are when they're having a mental health crisis or their loved one is having a mental health crisis. They don't know where to go, so they go to the hospital emergency room. And those guidelines to get admitted to the hospital are really pretty rigid. I mean, you have to be in danger to yourself or someone else. And this is for people who are experiencing a crisis, but they're not. They don't plan on hurting themselves or somebody else. They just need somebody to talk to. So they're not going to be going to the hospital. And then in terms of, we think that it's also going to cut down on folks going to jail, because a lot of times what will happen is if someone is having a psychotic episode, they could be having symptoms, and that will then trigger a call to the police. And instead of taking that person to jail for a minor offense, the police department can bring folks down to the crisis center for an assessment and really get them to the services that they need instead of taking them to the jail, which is a safe place but probably not the most appropriate place for someone experiencing a mental health crisis or who's potentially psychotic.
And finally, Cynthia, how is all this being paid for, the new center?
Polk County Health Services has really stepped up to the plate. They have always, when they see a need in the community, they try to meet that need, and that's what they've done here. And Polk County Health Services, they're funding the startup for this as well as ongoing funding.
Okay, Cynthia Steidel-Bishop, Chief Operating Officer for Ierley Ball Community Mental Health Services. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Friday News Buzz on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. A chance for us to look at some of the news through quick conversations in Iowa this week. This week, a breach affecting five department servers at Iowa State University was discovered. ISU says the compromised servers contained Social Security numbers of nearly 30,000 students enrolled at Iowa State between the years of 1995 and 2012. Iowa State University's Senior Vice President and Provost Jonathan Wickert joins me now. Provost Wickert, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to join you today.
How serious is this breach? What information was on those servers?
Well, as you know, we had a hacking incident where some hackers broke into five of the computer servers on our campus. And we believe that their intent was to use the computing power of these machines to produce a digital currency known as Bitcoin. But as we investigated the problem, we learned that there were some class lists that had been stored on several of these computers. And we have no evidence that those class lists were downloaded, nor do we have evidence that that they were even viewed. But we wanted to take the very cautious step of notifying the students on those class lists that their information was exposed and possibly viewed.
So to be clear, if I'm understanding you right, it seems these hackers had no interest in the data. They just liked the ISU computing power to create this currency on the internet known as Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's how we see it. We have learned that this particular type of computer server, that there are many of them around the world, and that many of them have actually been broken into with the same software that had been uploaded to produce these bitcoins. Well, and the basic idea is that if the hackers can hijack these computers, by having many computers, it's like having one giant computer, and it allows them to do this work faster.
Is there something special about these particular servers that makes them so attractive to these hackers for this purpose?
Well, they seem to have been able to identify a particular vulnerability of this brand of server and the software that was running on it. And I think it's that vulnerability that allowed them to gain access to it. So once we found out that our computers had been breached. We quickly went in and patched it and repaired them and then actually removed them from our network entirely.
How was the breach discovered? How did you learn about it, and when did you learn about it?
Well, what we found out was that several of these machines were running particularly slowly. And, you know, it's not uncommon for a computer to run faster or slower sometimes, but we observed over a period of time that these servers were running much slower than they were expected to. And so on February 28th, we noticed that they had been hacked into. We immediately took them offline and repaired them over that weekend.
Mm-hmm. So you said this problem, this vulnerability has been patched. Does that assure that this sort of thing won't happen again?
Well, you know, this particular incident has been repaired. We scanned our entire network. You know, on any given day, we have about 100,000 devices connected to the Iowa State network. So it's a very large and complex system. But we went through and we scanned the entire network. And so we're confident that we have the full scope of this intrusion addressed. But, you know, we live in a very digital society, and we hear about a new hacking incident on a weekly, if not daily, basis at some company or university or government organization. And, you know, this time, despite our best protective efforts, these hackers, these criminals, were able to find a chink in our armor.
We have about a minute left. Law enforcement involved here?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We brought in our police force very early on in the process. And we have skill here in terms of computer forensics and are following up appropriately, as you might expect. But, you know, the reality is these hackers could be anywhere around the world, and that's the nature of computer crime.
To reiterate here, nearly 30,000 students, their Social Security numbers on these servers. You don't think at this time that they were interested in this data. But you said all of these nearly 30,000 students from 95 to 2012 at ISU will be notified?
Yeah. In fact, we have sent out letters to all of those students earlier in the week and are offering identity protection and credit monitoring service to them. And, you know, we have no reason to believe that their information is being used, but we're really trying to take an approach of being very cautious and very thorough and doing the best to keep our students and Iowans informed about this situation.
Okay, Iowa State University Senior Vice President and Provost Jonathan Wickard, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Talking about a breach affecting five department servers at Iowa State University this week. It's a river-to-river news buzz, and that will continue after a short break. When we come back, we'll talk with Dean Borg about last night's U.S. Republican Senate candidate debate. Also, Amy Mayer will be along on the talk about the evolution of the local food movement. And did you hear that the Des Moines-based publisher Meredith Corporation is ceasing the monthly production of one of its signature magazines? It's been around for some 131 years. Ladies Home Journal has a big change coming up. We'll talk about that in the second half hour. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay buckled up. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come on this Friday News Buzz edition of the program in just a few minutes, we'll hear from Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. She'll talk about the evolution of the local food movement. But first, five Republican candidates hoping to run for U.S. Senate gathered in Johnston last night for their first televised live debate. This comes as an early primary voting begins throughout the state. The candidates included former talk show host and economics professor Sam Clovis, former U.S. District Attorney Matt Whitaker, Ames businessman Scott Shaben, former energy executive Mark Jacobs, and State Senator Joni Ernst. The candidates gathered at Iowa Public Television Studios in Johnston before a small live audience, and Dean Borg moderated that discussion. He joins us now. Hello, Dean.
Hello, Ben.
Tell us, what were the themes, the issues that dominated the discussion last night in this 90-minute face-off, I guess we'll say?
Well, the issues were brought up by the panel questioning. And that was Kay Henderson of Radio Iowa, James Lynch of the Gazette, published in Cedar Rapids, and Des Moines Register political columnist Kathy Obradovich. So they, you might say, set the issues. And I point that out because candidates were free, because it was an open, not structured debate. It was an open debate forum, you might say, where the candidates could have, if they had wanted to, bring up whatever they want to in order to differentiate themselves from the others. And that was decidedly absent last night. And I think that's the thing that I took away from that debate, that the candidates passed up an opportunity to set themselves apart from the others whom they will be competing with in the June 3rd primary.
I understand one of the big themes last night was the reduction of the federal government, downsizing the federal government. Let's listen to a short clip by Joni Ernst speaking. She's talking about the reduction of the size of the government, and she was asked how she would balance the U.S. budget and come up with money for infrastructure, for instance.
I do believe that we can make the cuts necessary within our federal government to find a way to fund our roads and infrastructure. We've already talked about closing the door to the IRS. I think that would be a wonderful start. Let's close the door. Let's scrap the tax code. And again, let's find something that's fairer, flatter, and simpler. But then there's other departments that we could be looking at also. And I've talked about these before, but closing the doors to the Department of Education at the federal level, and not just because it would save taxpayer dollars, but because I do believe that our children are better educated when it's coming from the state and the localities. I do believe that we should do that. Another area that we need to look at is the Environmental Protection Agency. When we talk about the rules and regulations that are burdening business owners, whether it's in ag, whether it's in industry here in the state of Iowa, let's shut down the federal EPA and focus on those issues here in the state where the state knows best how to protect
the resources. Mr. Jacobs,
so last night's talk, Dean, had a lot of getting rid of big chunks of the federal government.
Yes, it was not surprising.
Right?
And nobody challenged. In fact, a few threw in with that same idea. In fact, you know, Morningside professor, faculty member, radio talk show host, former Air Force pilot, Sam Clovis, really set the tenor, I thought, of the debate early on when he, in making a statement, he said, "You can't be too conservative." And he was talking about himself as a candidate in this election. And I guess you can understand that if you're going into the Republican primary where and you're looking for votes there. But you come out with a statement like that and no one really challenges you. As I went down the way of the other candidates there, Joni Ernst, Mark Jacobs, Scott Shaben, and Matt Whitaker, no one really disagreed with that. So there were no, if you will, elbows thrown last night. But you can't be too conservative. How is that going to play, you might ask, in the general election where you're going against the Obama administration and Bruce Braley? How is that going to play with independence?
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Bruce Braley in just a moment, but to follow up on what you just said, we know that the GOP tent nationally, the tent represents, it covers a number of political camps within the GOP, the Libertarian Tea Party wing, conservative Christians, also the so-called mainstream Republicans. You're saying that is this spectrum represented in this group of five that we had last night?
Well, it's going to be hard to say because they have to win this primary. And then we'll see as they go into the general election. But you'd have to say currently, in the way they're positioning themselves, no. Mm-hmm. And they're passing up the opportunity to differentiate themselves.
The primary is June 3rd. The winner will go up against 1st District Democratic Congressman Bruce Braley in the general election for this open Senate seat left open by the retirement of Tom Harkin. So a lot of this directed, you said, towards Bruce Braley and Obama, clumping them together.
Yes.
Were they indications of what they said of what they perceived to be his weaknesses, the strategy they planned to beat
Braley?
Well, Obamacare came up several times. In fact, they took the opportunity whenever possible to, in some way, even obliquely, criticize Obamacare. So I think that that is going to be an issue.
In fact, we have this cut from Matt Whitaker, the former U.S. District Attorney, talking about Obamacare, also tax reform. Let's have a quick listen.
And the tax code now has five times approximately the number of words of the Bible and none of the good news. And we need fundamental tax reform. We need it now. And it really is something that I've been calling for the last 10 months. Until we get this done, we're going to continue to have this stagnation, and we need to repeal Obamacare. It is a wet blanket on our nation's economy. It has to go. It is causing doubt and worry among our small business owners and our job creators, and it is time.
Former U.S. District Attorney Matt Whitaker, one of the five candidates. Dean, we have less than a minute left, but so I wonder if this is about electability for Republican primary voters. Who can beat Braley?
Well, that's what they're going to have to decide, and it remains to be seen whether or not any of these candidates, Ben, will be able to get 35% or whether this selection will go to a convention. Could I change the subject just briefly?
We have about 30 seconds, sure,
okay.
But go ahead.
I just finished an Iowa press taping with Republican activist, former gubernatorial aide Doug Gross and Danny Carroll, who's the state party chair. And Doug Gross, I thought, made some news in that taping just a few minutes ago, in which he said concerning the Branstad administration's current problems and the political campaign against Jack Hatch, Doug Gross said that he worked at one time with Branstad, that Branstad is a delegator. And he said he is going to have to make some changes in his administration in order to move strongly into this campaign. I thought that was news when Doug Gross, former aide to Branstad, says he's going to have to make some administrative changes.
Thank you. Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Quick conversations of news items that would have otherwise breezed by us this week. Nationwide, and you've noticed this, the popularity of local food has skyrocketed over the last couple of decades. Now, available figures are somewhat hazy, but in the 1990s, just to give you an idea of this, the 1990s, local food sales in the U.S. were likely under $500 million. Let's go to 2008. That's the most recent year for which the USDA has published statistics. That figure goes to $5 billion. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer, also a reporter for Iowa Public Radio, joins us now to discuss the evolution of the local food movement here in Iowa, which she's been reporting on. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
So let's make sure we know what we're talking about. When we talk about local food, if I go to my grocery store and pick up a nicely colored pepper in the produce aisle, does that necessarily mean it's local food?
There are lots of different ways people define local food. So I would say at your local grocery store, if you pick up that pepper and it has a sticker on it and it says product of USA, and then it says a California farm or a farm someplace else that's far away, then no, that pepper wouldn't be local. But if it's under a sign that says local produce and it has a label near it that says this came from such and such farm in the county, two counties over from your grocery store, that's probably going to count as local in most people's minds.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we think of local foods, we often think of farmers markets, of course, and they have grown tremendously in recent years. We just love our farmer markets, don't we?
But we're
talking about much more than farmers markets here when we talk about the local food movement, aren't we?
Yes, we are. And the farmers markets were the example of one of the first really popular direct-to-consumer methods of getting local food out there. Direct to consumer, as in I buy it from a farmer or the farmer's employee who I see at the market. Community supported agriculture is another direct to consumer. You pay a certain amount for the season, and every week you get something fresh from your farm. Now we've moved into what the wonky wonks like to call intermediated markets, which is where a farmer is selling to either a regional food hub or they're selling to a local grocery store or another avenue, a hospital, a school district, where then the consumer is going to eat that food.
Mm-hmm. What have been the hurdles to getting it past that direct-to-consumer thing? Because I assume you're talking about greater volumes when you do make that leap over the hurdle.
Absolutely. There's two areas that I think have been hurdles. On the one hand, just like you said, is volume. The people who grow large-scale quantities of any kind of commodity have had their established ways of selling that, and going one-on-one to a buyer wasn't usually in their formula. Also, for the buyers, they are very often accustomed to working with a supplier who works with many, many producers, and so the buyer, the hospital, the school district, whatever, can just say routinely, I want this many pounds of this thing, and they don't have to worry about where it's coming from. And so it took a lot of grassroots effort on both sides, on the producer side and on the consumer side, to find ways to make it possible to connect growers nearby a buyer.
So, Amy, do we know right now in 2014 how much local food is landing on lunch tables at our schools in Iowa?
We don't have data for the current school year, but there was a survey done by USDA for the 2011-2012 school year, and it found that nationally about $354 million of local school purchases were within the local communities.
And do we know anything specifically about Iowa?
Here in Iowa, it was about $1 million of school meal money spent in local communities.
Okay, and we can expect that trend to be growing, I would imagine.
The school district surveyed 40 to 50% or more of them said they intended to make more purchases locally in the coming school years.
Now, some may wonder, Amy, why eat local when I'm, depending on how you define it, when I'm perfectly happy with the produce that's been shipped from, oh, I don't know, California or perhaps Mexico, who knows where. What is the benefit? Why? What should motivate me?
I think that's an interesting question because I think that sort of gets into philosophy as much as anything else. But some of the reasons that people support buying food locally is, first of all, it's often fresher because it has less time has elapsed from when it was picked until it lands on your table. And so for that reason, some people think it tastes better. There's a lot of disagreement or controversy surrounding whether there's less of an environmental impact if you purchase foods locally. The thinking is that if the food spends less time in transport to you, then fewer greenhouse gases are emitted in the process. But there are a lot of nuances to that that make that not very conclusive. And then, of course, there's the benefit to the local economy. If you're spending your money locally, it ripples out within your own area. And in particular, you're supporting the farmers who are growing that food in your region, and that helps to keep those businesses, those farm businesses, going.
Of course, many families on budgets concerned about what buying local may do to their food budgets. Is it necessarily more expensive?
It's not inherently more expensive, although it can be. It can also be more effort, because if your local grocery store doesn't have it, then maybe you do have to go to the farmer's market to get it. But increasingly, hopefully, there will be more stores and more avenues to purchasing it. But it is, you know, like so many things that happen with food trends, there's always that concern that if it costs more, a lot of people aren't going to have access to it.
We enjoyed your reporting from Northeast Iowa in particular, where there is a very innovative local food environment, places like Decorah and Waukon. What lessons, what takeaway did you have from that experience?
I think the most interesting thing that I took from that was the way this system emerged was it started with a group of farmers, a group of producers who were meeting with an extension agent and talking about what do we have that's unique here in this region? What can we do that would help our farms survive, help our businesses survive, that would really take advantage of what we do best and what our community would support and would be most interested in. And the reason I found that so fascinating is that it seems, particularly in urban areas, that the push for local food has largely come from the consumers, from the people who want to eat it, from people who are very concerned about what it is that they're eating. And in this region, in Northeast Iowa, which has really been held up as a model of one way to make a system like this work, it started with the farmers.
Mm-hmm. And these values that they pushed to help us eat more local foods are being adopted by greater numbers of people.
Greater numbers of people and larger size buyers. You know, it's
hospitals, it's schools, as we discussed.
Colleges, exactly. So it's become something that I think is on the radar of people in a much broader sector of food consumption or food buying.
Okay, Amy Mayer, get out your locally made crystal ball and look into it. Where is the trend towards local foods taking us?
Local food buying, I think, is here to stay, at least for the medium term. I suspect somewhat less attention will be paid to it as it becomes more routine. are we ever going to go back to a day where you're only eating the things that can be produced or stored in the place that you live? I don't think so. I think there will always be a demand for bananas in the United States.
They ain't going to be growing 2 miles down the road.
Exactly. Exactly. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't make an effort to perhaps get our pork and beef from producers within our own states.
Okay. Harvest Public Media's and Iowa Public Radio's Amy Mayer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Des Moines-based publisher Meredith Corporation is ceasing the monthly production of one of its signature magazines, Ladies Home Journal, which has been around for 131 years. It will become a special interest quarterly magazine instead and sold only on newsstands, but also have a digital presence. Art Sluzark is the Chief Communications Officer at Meredith Corporation. He joins us today. Hi, Art.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Why has Meredith chosen to take this route?
Well, I think for several reasons. Number one, it's a challenging environment out there in the women's service field. And when we looked at our whole portfolio, we decided that for the best interest of the company and for the Ladies Home Journal brand, we should transition it from a monthly subscription magazine to a quarterly newsstand publication.
Of course, Meredith publishes many magazines. You said a challenging area. What are the specific challenges that this magazine faces, Ladies Home Journal?
Well, when you look at a Ladies Home Journal, one of the biggest challenges it faces, it has a very high median age for the titles in its competitive set. So its median age is 57, and ad buyers are always trying to reach younger and younger, want to reach, you know, more of the younger baby boomers and young adults. So that's one of the challenges it has. Also, it's, you know, when you look at the field, we already have two category leaders in Better Homes and Gardens and Family Circle. And so those magazines are strong, vibrant, and they've, you know, that's one challenge that LHJ faced going against those titles. Mm-hmm. Additionally, you've seen a lot of other magazines enter what has become a women's lifestyle field. On Meredith's end, we have a magazine called More, Every Day with Rachel Ray, Eating Well. We just started a new magazine called All Recipes. Now, while these may sound more niche-oriented, they really serve that women's service, women's lifestyle field.
Is this move, changing to a quarterly magazine for Ladies Home Journal, part of a longer-term phase-out, given the demographics, the older demographics of the readers?
No, we think it's not a consumer issue. It's more of an advertiser issue. There is a strong consumer base, 3.2 million circulation, that want to receive this magazine. So we're going to, you know, our goal is threefold. We want to serve the current LHJ readers and advertisers, and we're going to try to do that in two ways. Number one, through the new quarterly publication that'll be available on the newsstand, and it'll be of higher quality, better paper. And number two, also through other Meredith titles that may serve areas of interest to the LHJ reader, you know, whether it's particularly some sort of decorating style with Better Homes, food with Family Circle or Rachel Ray, health with Eating Well or fitness. So we think we can serve that consumer and advertiser with those particular titles. Our second goal is to take the advertising that was in LHJ and move it to other Meredith magazines. We think we have the perfect place for these advertisers. Mm-hmm. And our third goal, as I stated earlier, is to really improve the long-term vitality and viability of the brand. We had a similar magazine called Country Home that in 2009 we transitioned to a newsstand-only special interest publication. And 5 years later, the brand is profitable and still going strong.
This announcement of the change to the Ladies Home Journal came during Meredith's earnings call yesterday when your company reported a 37% decrease in profits. I guess this is compared to the profits from a year ago. Why did you suffer such a decrease in profits?
The earnings report you're referring to included a special charge we took in this quarter that wasn't in the last quarter a year ago. So really, on a comparable basis, when you look at apples-to-apples operations of the company, our profits dropped 2.8%, not 37%. So that was kind of a misnomer that was reported in the paper.
Mm-hmm. We know the newspaper industry went over a cliff several years ago in this digital age, many going belly up or downsizing. How are magazines different in the digital age? They're struggling as well, right?
Well, Matt, it's the brand we look at. Our goal is to deliver content to 100 million American women across the platform that they want to receive it, be it a print magazine, be it a tablet edition, be it a website, be it videos, be it broadcast programming. And if you look at Meredith's portfolio, our brands, that's what we do with our brands. We stretch them across multiple platforms to deliver the content that women want. Our magazine business, I mean, we don't have 100 million American women running up to us, banging on our door saying, don't send us my magazine anymore. That's not the case. It's more of an advertiser issue where a lot of dollars have moved to different platforms. And the biggest competitor that traditional media faces is really Google, Facebook, and those types of companies. They've taken a lot of advertising dollars off the table.
Will Ladies Home Journal have an online presence?
Yes. Ladies Home Journal will continue to have a very vibrant website, www.lhj.com, and will also be available in a tablet edition. So we're going to continue to serve that LHJ consumer. And the median age for LHJ digitally is about 10 years younger than it is for a print version.
Art Sluzark is the Chief Communications Officer at Meredith Corporation. Thanks, Art.
Thank you, Ben.
And that does it for this News Buzz edition of River to River. Our program is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury, with help today from Julie Englander. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.